Hey, hi. Welcome to Someone Else's Movie, the original podcast where an actor, writer, director, or nebulous industry figure gives a little love to a movie they didn't make. I'm Norm Wilner, senior film writer for Now Magazine, and this is the other thing I do. My guest this week is Kyle Rideout, an actor you may have seen in Legends of Tomorrow, iZombie, The Arrangement, or that first Deadpool movie, and whom you may have heard in Littlest Pet Shop, Beat Bugs, and My Little Pony, Friendship is Magic. He's also a filmmaker, having directed a number of shorts, and the experimental Edward Muybridge biopic, Edward. His new film, Adventures in Public School, a comedy which played TIFF last fall as Public Schooled, is now available for sale and rental on iTunes and Amazon Video in the US, and available for pre-order on iTunes in Canada. Kyle picked Amelie, Jean-Pierre Jeunet's 2001 romantic fantasy starring Audrey Tautou as a Montmartre cafe waitress with an inner life so rich that it very nearly compensates for her lack of any external connections. And if that sounds a little sad, well, it is. And Jeunet makes that thread of pathos essential to appreciating the candy-colored world in which he places his heroine. You can still enjoy it as a simple romantic comedy, and people absolutely did, but it's a deeper, richer work than its marketing campaign implied, and I'm really glad we got to talk about it. So here we go. This is someone else's movie.
It is why I love films. And like going to that, seeing it in the theater, I saw it at Fifth Ave Vancouver. It is magical and fun and joyful. Like leaving the theater, I felt lighter. Like walking away and I was floating a little bit. Oh. And I think that Jeunet captured the essence of that, joy and fun in that film, and magic. And there's another films that I was thinking about Pan's Labyrinth, which I really love the magic in that, but it's all got this kind of edge to it. There Will Be Blood is another one that I'm obsessed with, but Amelie is kind of the first film. And I saw it when I was at a very, young age in my teens, and it really, kind of opened my eyes to the world of filmmaking, and it's just delightful.
I was going to ask if this was the first time you'd encountered Jeunet. Had you seen his other stuff?
Or? I hadn't seen his other stuff. Okay. So after I watched this, then I needed to see Delicatessen, and I watched some of his shorts, and where he does the things I like, things I don't like.
Oh, yeah.
There's a short about that. And it was inspiring for my first film, Hop the Twig, which was a short film that I did. And, even my lead character is very similar to the young Amelie in this. but that film just kind of transports you. And yeah, I also love how it's kind of got this nostalgic feel, but without like a time period. Like it feels like older, like you can't quite nail down the time period, but then you see like a VW Bug, like one of the modern ones in the background. So you're like, okay, I think we're modern, but there's kind of this nostalgic older feel to it.
Yeah. Well, he's always had this fascination with clockworks and gears and synchronized things that are very mechanical and tactile.
Right.
Those aren't Polaroids, they're photo booth images that he's using in Amelie.
Yes.
And the technology is all very quaint, even though it's modern.
Right.
I mean, even like a modern VW is still an adorable car.
Yeah.
And his sensibility of it's like a jewelry box. It's like he's opened up this box of all these glittery, weird, shiny, strange things that he found on the street. There's nothing new, really.
It's he's capturing classicness. Like he doesn't have, an IKEA bookshelf in his movie. He has everything is kind of interesting and unique, even the items.
Old wooden chairs with interesting carvings on the sides and things like that.
Yeah, and then the camera work I find incredible too. In that, where even when she finds that little box, and you just flip into the memory of who owned that box,
that's right, yes.
And and the things that you see, the items you see, play almost a different role. Like there's the little bicycle, and then it's like the Tour de France that he's like the boy is playing with, and then there's the photograph, and it actually doesn't have like the picture itself doesn't have special meaning. It's what covers the hole where he goes and peeks on the woman changing or doing the laundry or whatever. Yeah, and then the marbles, the day that he lost the marbles.
That's right.
Yeah, so I love, I think it's the feeling, like the joy. When I was younger, actually, I was really shy too. And I feel like I connect with Amelie herself, because like shyness is the villain in the movie. And I, you know, as you know, young teenager, I was actually really quite shy. And so, yeah, this is an incredible movie. And the score,
yes.
The score makes that film, like, that was incredible too.
Yeah, it swoons for you.
Yeah, like, it does. Just,
it carries you along. My first encounter with it would have been at TIFF, I think.
Right, because it didn't play Cannes.
Right, it was Venice, I think, where it premiered, right?
Right, I can't so remember. I know that they were very surprised that it didn't, that Cannes said no to it. And they were like, really?
Yeah.
That was like a thing.
You think they were punishing him for Alien Resurrection?
Like, maybe.
You sold out, you can't come back.
Yeah, but they didn't play it, yeah.
Yeah, his career is so, I mean, Delicatessen is such a strange, off-putting, wonderful masterpiece.
It is.
And then from there, The City of Lost Children, we can run through his filmography if you like. It's just those were films that you somehow had to drag people to in order to convince them it was worth seeing.
It's not like a movie you're like, I gotta get there and go see it. Because it's like this unique voice. His voice is so clear and strong, and his vision in these films are so clear and strong. Mm-hmm. But he transports you to another world.
Yeah, and people didn't want to go there. And in the earlier films of the 90s.
Right, it was a small audience that were digging his films.
Well, at TIFF, you know, Delicatessen was here, and the distributor was, at the time, Malofilm, long since gone. I think they're Mongrel Media now. They evolved into, I think that's what came out of it. Huh. But Malo had sales agents, if I'm remembering this correctly, at TIFF in 92, were running around with little gold pig pins. And there was no logo, there was nothing, it was just the little gold pig, the half pig, the same.
Yeah, from that on the title.
From the hanging sign.
Or, yeah.
And
that'd be a good pin to get. I'd like that pin.
I think I still have mine, because if you wore it, it was a sign of how cool you were.
I wish you had two.
And I was a child.
So then you could give me one.
If I find it, you're welcome to. It's not been worn in 25 years. But it was one of those things where if you had the pin, it was the common language of, oh, you know, you've seen it.
Right.
And then for whatever reason, even though art house cinema was at a peak, you couldn't get people in. It was more of a hit in the States. It was more of a hit in Europe and Canada. It just didn't happen.
Wow.
And so when City of Lost Children came out, I found myself in the same exact position of, oh, no, it's the guy who made Delicatessen. And people said, what?
What is
and,
that?
Yeah. And you were just fighting this uphill battle. And then Amelie comes out and all of a sudden,
people were like, oh, I get it.
Yeah,
Mark Carr. What was that movie you said? Delicatessen? Okay, maybe I'll check it out.
Yeah, it retroactively makes all of his movies make sense to people.
Right.
And I don't
understand. It's like the masterpiece of the vision, the original visions, and then people, like, they were able to get it.
Yeah, it's like it unlocks it retroactively. And I don't understand why that is, because it feels like the culmination. It's like, how do you jump into this for the first time and see Amelie? Because tonally, it's so different, too. It's a much happier and more optimistic movie, even though, as you say, it's about a woman who does all these things for other people so she doesn't have to confront her own lack of a life.
Exactly.
And, yeah, I mean, I'm delighted that it worked. I'm delighted that it clicked with audiences finally, but it's like, where were you 10 years ago, guys? This is the same guy.
And then there's, like, narration for the first...
Oh, that's right.
For the first long section of it. And she doesn't start in the cafe until, I don't know what it is, maybe 15 minutes in or something.
Say 15 or 20.
Yeah, and I think that that's also interesting, too, because, you know, when you start looking at film structure, it's, you know, you need something to happen, and he's just telling you a story of what's going on, and you're totally following, like these things that people like and don't like. He doesn't like his swim shorts getting stuck to his legs as he gets out of the pool, and he doesn't like people looking at his sandals, and you're just like, I don't like people looking at my sandals. You're like, I get this. I don't like, or like going to the bathroom and someone is like going next to you. And I'm like, oh, that was the first time that you're just like, I don't know, seeing that in the audience, you know, I was like, oh yeah, I get that. I get that.
So what was your understanding of it when you went? Was it just a movie you saw that day or had you heard anything about it?
No, I had heard, I had started to hear about it and, you know, from friends. I was just starting to go to I think I was just starting to go to acting school.
Okay.
Where I was at the very end of high school. And so I think it was through some acting friends who, you know, were on the vibe of more of this type of a film. So it was still in the early days of it, but I think it was, you know, it was only playing at a couple of theaters in Vancouver, yeah, like the Art House theaters. And yeah, so I went and saw it and, you know, was transported. And I was like, I have to see everything of his.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is such a, oh, it's a great gateway drug. It really is. Because yeah, you also, you come away with, you know, you discover Matthew Kasovitz and Yamel Debbouze and all these people in it who are lively and part of that culture.
Yeah.
It's like the best possible circumstance to discover a cinema,
yeah,
a type of cinema. And yeah,
he uses a lot of the same people, which I thought, mm-hmm, was interesting. He used Audrey Tautou for a long time.
Engagement. Yeah. Engagement. Which somehow nobody saw, which was one of the best movies I saw that year.
I know. And I love that film.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I actually, this is the way I got people to see it. I tricked them when the DVD came out. I didn't trick them, but I said, if you rent the, I used the Jodie Foster trivia point, which is that she's fluent in French and dubs all her own performances for French releases. And that was like, oh yeah, you can hear her speak French in A Very Long Engagement. Maybe you should go see that. And that was how I got people to see that movie.
I didn't know that she did the dubs, though.
Yeah, it's kind of cool.
That's really cool. Yeah, that's fascinating.
The Panic Room one is apparently really good.
Right.
Because she modulates the accent and the emotion, which is usually like when people are doing another language, their own accent, or how does it work? When people are speaking another language or affecting another accent, the more you raise your voice, the less comfortable you are. Like it all.
Oh, when you start going higher,
yeah,
up.
Yeah, if you're shouting or if you're being intense, your own accent, your own voice will come through. Apparently, it's a quirk.
Interesting.
But Foster gets it. And
she gets it and she's able to nail it.
Yeah.
Now I need to learn French and then watch some stuff.
To properly judge.
Yeah.
This is like learning Russian so you can read Karamazov.
Exactly.
I mean, sure, if you have time.
Yeah. I speak some Japanese, and so maybe I should try to do some Japanese for...
Cool.
No, I don't think that's right.
It would be more true to your character.
Yeah.
If you're dubbing it.
Yeah.
But that's just one more thing, one more weird difficulty that somehow creates itself around his work, where uh-huh, Amélie doesn't have any of that.
Right.
Like, Very Long Engagement is this deeply sad, optimistic love story.
Yeah.
Just like Amélie.
Right.
I guess. But Amélie, somehow by being slightly more cartoonish, allows itself to be perceived as more accessible.
Yeah.
Of all of his films.
I know.
Because he's just experimenting with digital a little bit. People's eyes get a bit too big and their smiles are a little too wide. And it's,
and the whole thing is colored, mm-hmm, like these very extravagant colors,
yeah,
the whole thing, the green and the red, the little blues in the background. Yeah, I think it's... that was the one that really hit with the audiences. It was really easy for people to get into it.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know how that, why it's not with, you know, the other films.
Yeah, because this does defy a lot of rules in that same way, which is it shouldn't have been a mainstream hit. It shouldn't, mm-hmm, have caught on, especially in America, where there's so much hostility. I know, it was up for
5 Oscars or something. It, yeah, won a number of Oscars. And
I think so.
So it really, it really landed with people.
Yeah, and it is just... lovable. I mean, it's just it's a really good movie.
Yeah.
I know,
and I love the little quirks in it, like, you know, the pig that reaches over and turns off the light, and it's like, you know, there's no explanation that a pig just starts doing that. It just happens. It's magic, right?
It's a fable.
She's starting to fall asleep.
Yeah. And there's something truly wonderful about the idea of the character as an innocent that the world is trying to take care of.
Right.
That for all the things she does, her environment is actually
making
sure she's okay.
Yeah.
Which is how she's got to this point.
It's Cinderella.
Yeah, yeah, it is,
the animals,
right?
Like coming the animals and are making the dress for her.
Yeah. And it's, and with Tautou, you believe it, because she's so...
I know, and she was a model before she made this film. Like, mm-hmm, she wasn't an actor, and he brought her into the world of acting, I think.
That sounds about right.
Yeah.
It's always surprised me that she was a model at all, because she's so... She's not, I mean, she's strikingly beautiful, but she's also really idiosyncratic. I don't see, you don't see her putting on a mask to pose.
Right,
ever.
Yeah.
Like, she's always human.
Yeah.
That she's in the Da Vinci Code, and it's uncomfortable because she's too real to be in this big cartoon of a movie.
Right.
She's just playing a person.
Right. I never saw the Da Vinci
Code.
It's
not good.
Okay.
No.
Well, I'm good. I'll just jot that down.
And now my brain is going, was she in the first one or the second one? Because they're all... she was in the first one. Then it was a Yell at Zur. And then the last one was Felicity Jones.
Okay. I missed all of them.
It's all just like Dan Brown always likes the female lead to be 20 years younger than Tom Hanks and also dark haired and tall.
Right. Right.
I guess. It's a thing.
It's a thing.
It's amazing that...
people have those things.
Yeah, it's amazing that, you know, as he travels the world, this incredible Harvard symbologist always finds the assistant who looks exactly like the last one, but that there's no connection to them.
Yeah.
Over 20 years.
Look where. Yes. You just happen to be here.
That's the next clue. The tall, dark-haired woman. She'll help you.
I must be in the right... I must be getting close. This is the right direction.
Yeah, but Tattoo has been far more successful in French cinema than in Hollywood stuff, just because... I don't know, like, maybe it's the presumption that audiences won't know what to do with her because she's the girl from Amelie, or the presumption that audiences haven't seen Amelie, so she's not marketable.
Yeah, I don't know what happens when an actor plays such a strong role that then it's hard to, you know, it's hard to see them as another as another person. Because you're like, you're Walter White. What are you doing outside of Breaking Bad?
Yeah.
That's where you're Walter White. You've got to be doing your...
You have to be mean to people.
You have to be mean to people.
But, well, with Tattoo, at least she's removed from the world of them. You know, if she's in another movie, she won't be in the same environment. The colors are more normal.
Yeah.
But she's still...
And the haircut. Somehow, that iconic haircut. I remember that haircut being, like, a thing, too.
That's right. It's Louise Brooks by way of the 21st century, but...
Oh.
Yeah. I mean, I've always assumed that kind of page boy thing.
Right.
But even just looking... Sorry, I'm holding up the DVD case, listener. And you can just see the contrast between the poster image and the way she actually looks in the film is really... I'd forgotten just how radical a departure is, because she looks much more like a person.
I know.
In the movie itself, because, of course...
They make her look like a mime on the front.
Yeah. And that's another way around. Like, this film has subtitles. Maybe there won't be any dialogue.
Yeah.
It's an easier sell.
Right.
But
a sugar rush of a movie is what it says in the front of it, and I think that that's what it is.
It is, yeah. But it still has emotional gravity. It has weight, which is why I love it. Rather than that was a lovely diversion, and let's leave and talk about the cinematography and never think of it again.
It
hangs around because there is an underlying sadness and melancholy. I mean, it's French,
melancholy.
Of course, it's melancholy,
right?
But she's so good at carrying that. This is a movie about a woman who's in denial of where her life is.
Yeah, and she needs to... Her real problem is facing her own fears that she needs to get past. And it's so simple, too. It's a really simple structure, and it works so well. And then she's, you know, making her cake at the end of the movie and is very sad and crying because things didn't work out. I like how not everything worked out when she started helping people, like the couple.
Oh, that's right.
That, you know, go into the bathroom and sex, and then they start fighting, and he gets weird and starts tape recording her calls, and that relationship started to fall apart, and she's like, what have I done? And then he shows up at the door. Then they ride on a scooter really quickly at the end, which is, right?
Well, the scooter symbolizes...
They're on their way.
Yeah, but it's also... symbolizes is the wrong word. It's a callback to... Roman Holiday and all that stuff. It's a callback to movies that aren't involved in this film, which I find really interesting too. Like, Genet is accessing pieces of cinema history constantly without ever hanging a lantern on it or quoting directly. There's just even the choice of music is sort of just there's a lot of accordion and self-consciously. Yeah, exactly. It's the thing you think of when you think of French cinema. You create this fake thing in your head.
Exactly.
And he gives you that and then argues that the people inside that are still real.
Right.
And deserving of consideration, which is so great because nobody does that.
I know. Yeah, it's pretty... It's such a nice little trip to go on.
So how often do you come back to it?
Well, it was a real inspiration for me at, you know, the early stages of my career. Mm-hmm. And I have other many favorites now beyond that, but I think that this was like a really important film for me in my life and, you know, really set a good spark off for me. And, you know, my dream was to meet Junet and to, you know, I think it's funny when you do meet someone, you know, and you have to tell them this movie, you have to, like, when they see it, you see them grab their hand. This movie was amazing.
Yeah.
And I think that it's funny because the person on the other side, they're like, okay, that was in the past. And I've had, you know, 20 million people tell me that. But you know, you still need to tell the person that.
Yeah. Did you get to? Did you actually?
No, I haven't.
Oh.
I haven't.
He would, you know, he would really like that,
I think. I know, I think. Yeah.
I got to talk to him when he came through TIFF for Micmacs.
Okay.
So, 2010 maybe?
Right.
And it was the greatest and weirdest situation because we were in the Sutton Place Hotel, I think, and there was construction going on outside, and it was so loud. There was drilling constantly. The recording is inaudible for certain portions.
Oh, no.
And I had to, like, there's a moment where I'm shouting a question and he's shouting his answer. And,
awful.
And it's like, it was bad, but it was great because we were sharing this awful moment together with a sense of, this does sort of
feel... We gotta just keep going. There's nothing we can do. There's no time.
And it's life interfering.
You never have time there, Tiff.
Yeah.
You just gotta move on.
Maybe it was the Park Hyatt, but it was low to the ground and there was something loud outside. And it was just so strangely eccentric in the moment that it felt like a bonding experience. Like, you have to do this all day, don't you? It's like,
what was your inspiration for this movie?
Yeah, tell me about weapons trading.
Well, what?
And we talked about Amelie and we talked about Alien Resurrection a little bit. And he's just,
what were his feelings on Alien Resurrection?
Well, I just wanted to know
what a different departure from what he wants to do of Amelie.
Yeah.
It's like the exact opposite.
It kind of is. And he said that for him, it was the opportunity to work with digital tech on a level he'd never been allowed to do. And he said, you know, like, they offered me an Alien movie. I'm not going to say no. Those things are cool.
Yeah.
And the movie is more or less what he wanted it to be.
Right.
Because by the time he got to it, the rewrites had been, the script had been backed and forth for years. Uh-huh. And by the time he got to it, there was a script that he could work with. And he said it was a really interesting experience to work with an American studio. I get the feeling he didn't want to do it again.
Right.
Ever. But he's been making big movies on his own terms ever since.
Yeah.
Very Long Engagement was a really ambitious production.
Yeah, that was a huge film.
And Micmacs is smaller but more complicated.
Right.
I mean, he had said that Amelie was the film that he embraced. That was the opportunity. And
everything that he wanted.
Exactly. It all came together right after Alien Resurrection. You know, you just made a $70 million movie for an American studio. What do you want to do next? And it's like, oh, the thing I care about. This
yeah, that's
story.
What it seems like. It seems like there's pieces of his childhood within her and her curiosity in the world and all those little, like what you're saying, all those little interesting, clocks and photographs and nostalgic items in it that come to life.
It feels like a first novel, right?
Oh, yeah.
Like he's putting everything into it because he may never get the chance to do another one.
Right.
But it's his fourth feature. I mean, it was his second feature without Mark Caro, but Caro worked on this one.
Uh-huh.
They just didn't share directorial credits.
Right.
But it feels like this is the one where he's not missing any opportunities. He wants to get everything down.
Just jam it in. Just get it all in. Cut it to 130 minutes.
Yeah.
Or 90 minutes.
No, I think you're right the first time, right? It's 2 hours and something.
Okay.
But it's bursting with inspiration and energy and ideas. And even, like, every single image has been thought about.
Yes.
And maybe it's because with digital color timing, he worked over it for days and days in post. Every single frame is bespoke, you know, in a way that...
I also like the speed at which it's cut.
Uh-huh.
It's cut and shot very quickly.
That's right.
Like, even the end when they're doing the, you know, he kind of ramps stuff. He does these little ramps in the memory when goes to the Tour de France and that part is, all those memories are kind of ramped until they get to the marbles and then it all, like, slows down. But, and then the end of the film with the scooter, it's, like, ramped. And so I like the speed at which it moves. It doesn't let you, you know, sit back. Like, it's out at you and pulling you along really quickly. You were talking about the images in there, and I do have to say that I actually have the goose and the dog picture in my living room. I got prints of those and put them up just as, like, you know, a little inspiration of you know, the visual joy that he puts into this film that I think that, you know, filmmaking needs to have nowadays when you need to get people to the theater, which is so hard to do these days. And I think that, you know, as a filmmaker, it's our responsibility to put in visual joy and you know, that kind of beauty and excitement that, you know, you can walk away from.
Yeah. God, I mean, anything that gets people to connect emotionally with the film.
Yeah.
And especially to see it in a space where you're surrounded by other people making that same connection. It just, yeah. I mean, I'm lucky enough that I still get to do it a couple of times a week, but
yeah,
at press screenings, it's a different energy. And I mean, I saw Paddington 2 Wednesday night in a crowd, but it was filled with kids because it was a family screening, right? It was a preview, but it was seated with families. And there was a moment where the final plot point sort of drops, and it's not even a plot point. There's a moment where Paddington is underwater and people are trying to save him.
Uh-huh.
And you know, as an adult audience member, he's going to be fine. They're not. First of all, they're never going to. Paddington deserves only.
There's no Paddington 3, right? Exactly, is that what you're telling us?
Well, they're going to. They're guaranteeing
he doesn't get out of the water.
Survival of the franchise is paramount. But when you're 4 or 5, you maybe don't know this, right? It might be the first time you've ever encountered it. And there was a child who gasped when he was rescued, and it was a gasp of such pure joy and relief. It's like, I forgot what that sounds like. I forgot what that feels like.
Yeah.
And the whole room rode off the gasp because everybody else was just like, oh. In the back of your mind, you're like in this moment with the kid for the first time. Yeah.
I came from the theater world, and so I've been an actor in a lot of Shakespeare productions. And I wonder about Shakespeare's plays, back in the time when they don't know that Romeo and Juliet don't end up, the end of it. That they would gasp at the, at the plot of what's happening. I feel like, what would they do during Hamlet? Oh my gosh.
That's right. He's behind the curtain.
Oh my gosh, because they don't know.
And I suppose, too, theater, like the energy of a live performance will lend itself to the energy of the crowd. And there are so few films that feel like they're happening in front of you.
Right.
Just because of the nature of, the way you watch a movie is...
Yeah.
To look at it and sit still, and it's two-dimensional and all of that stuff. But this, Amelie, I think there's a conspiratorial aspect of it too, the way that Tatu occasionally looks at the camera and sort of smiles. It invites you in the way she does.
Right. Yeah, I'm trying to think. She does that when she first gets introduced in the cafe.
Early on, the camera
shoots in, right?
Yeah, and then towards the end, she looks at the camera every 10 minutes more often, but there's a couple of moments where she's sort of coquettishly just sort of smiles.
Yeah, she's like, it's like winking at the, I know you're there.
And yeah. I mean, you can't help but root for the character, but that, I remember thinking that was a really bold choice for 2001. Uh-huh. It wasn't being done that much,
I know, and now we have Deadpool who's talking right to the camera and the credits are
they're jokey or...
Yeah.
And it works, it's fun.
Yeah.
But in a film about sadness, it's a different sort of aspect. The only other, I'm trying to think, it was the Déplechin film, Un Conte de Noël, A Christmas Tale. It was at Cannes in 2008. It was the only time I was at Cannes, so that I remember. But there is it's a moment where there's a sense of narration, there's a sense of engagement with the actors, and at the very end, one character looks at the camera and smiles. And it just lands like a fist in your chest. It feels like the fourth wall has just been shattered.
That's interesting. That's like 500 powerful. Days of Summer. He looks... He doesn't do it until the very end of the movie. And he looks and he winks at the audience when he meets Autumn.
And that's creepy.
Well, yeah.
When it happened in that film, I was like... Ugh.
Did you? I liked it. I was like, oh, all right. Hey.
Yeah.
I'll wink back. Hey. No.
I found it really... I'm not...
You were like, it was cringe. It was cringy
for you. It was a little bit much, yeah.
It was too much. I'm not...
Totally on board with 500 Days of Summer. I remember thinking at the time that it felt like someone was trying to make a movie that would play really well at Sundance and had that kind of energy and self-awareness. It felt
I think thinking that thought and watching it, it'd be a different thing.
Yeah.
I got on board. I like it when, when movies kind of distort reality and, she was on the bus and there's multiples of her all over the bus. Yeah. I'm like, oh, I'm digging this.
Oh, yeah.
I love it.
No, I didn't dislike it, but it just felt a little calculated in its adorability.
Yes.
Maybe. And then I saw Webb's last film, The Only Living Boy in New York, and it's like, oh, no, I was right. I feel completely... I haven't
seen it.
It is the... Ugh
is enough.
It's white privilege of the movie.
It
is so bad.
Right. I think that should be a review that you give.
I may have actually done that.
We had this review is one word.
We may have had this. We may have. I have definitely had this. I built a hashtag out of "fuck that was awful" for a while on Twitter, just because there were a few movies. It's like Transformers 4 kind of stuff, really grindingly awful. And I would just leave the screening, and I would email that to Glenn, to my editor.
Yeah.
And just like, don't worry about having space for the review. It's not going to take too long. But it just finally distilled itself into, fuck, that was awful. And then I started actually tweeting it publicly. And it's like, that seems kind of mean. You don't want to. You don't want that to be a brand.
You don't want that brand.
No.
Fuck, that was awful.
But
oh, that's the fuck, that was awful guy.
Yeah, you don't want to be that guy. But Amelie feels like it might have directly inspired 500 Days of Summer in that way, right? Like the kind of candy-colored imagery and structural stuff.
Yeah, 500 Days of Summer does the, she always wears red, and she always wears blue, sorry, and he wears red. So they kind of flipped the the colors, the, you know, the gender colors, because she's acting like the boy who, you know, is like not as interested in the girl, right? But she's, you know, he's chasing after the girl, which we hadn't seen very much. Boy meets girl. Boy loves girl. Girl doesn't.
Yeah.
Like, I think that's girl such a simple...
Girl means ambivalent.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's such an interesting, simple story. But...
Yeah, but then...
Yeah, maybe there was influences from Amelie. I wonder.
It felt like it. It felt like that was one of the sacred texts.
Yeah.
You know, like, they just... You know, how do you involve the audience in a story that they can't necessarily root for everyone in?
Right.
How do you suggest... the romantic fantasy that, that his character lives in, and it's, well, we'll just make everything really bright, we'll have a musical number, we'll exploit everything that's charming about Joseph Gordon-Levitt.
Yeah.
And it just, yeah, that was the thing that, like, the bell that rang in my head was like, oh, this this is sort of what an American Amelie would be like if you...
Oh, that's an interesting point, yeah.
Coming at it from that direction.
Yeah, it's an American Amelie. This is our version.
Yeah, but that, but that also... just reminds me how unrepeatable Amelie is, how you couldn't do another one.
I know. Well, it's, his voice is so clear and, and strong in it. You can't repeat that. You can't recreate it.
Yeah. Nor should you. Because it's, you know, what it is really good. It's just any, there are a handful of movies where the influence is so clear that, I mean, there, anytime someone tries to knock off Star Wars, you can tell. Anytime someone tries to knock off Die Hard, you can tell. It's usually genre stuff. But with Amelie, it's like, why would you even want to try to approach this? This guy did it.
He did it.
It's done.
It's done. Move on.
Yeah.
You can't do it.
Find another one.
Give up now.
Yes. Filmmakers listening, we're just telling you nicely. Don't do it.
We're sending you a memo.
We're watching and we're waiting.
And I just sent it. Check your email. Look in the junk box. Might be in there.
So that kind of awkwardly brings us to the question, like, have you borrowed or stolen or lifted anything from Amelie? I mean,
well, I think that it was influencing my first short film. That was the first thing that I made, was this little piece called Hop the Twig. And I actually, because I didn't go to film school or anything, that was kind of my film school, was this short, because I know, you know, when you go to film school, you know that you're going to make you do the shorts, and I'm like, well, I may as well just put my money that I'd spend on schooling into this film.
Right.
And, you know, made it for $1,000. And there was lots of little things that I took that I, that I stole from Amelie, basically, is like, you know, I had the narration to it because I didn't want to have live sound because I knew I'd be, that'd be kind of challenging as my first film doing all that. So I pulled all the sound out and just shot it silent and then I did it after. And so... there's only a couple of things that are said in the film, but, and then there's a couple of the camera moves that I really loved that I was inspired by Amelie. There's like the kind of quick push-ins and these kind of, whip pans that, that happen. And then there's this kind of almost floaty feel from Pan's Labyrinth. That's another film that, you know, I adore, but yeah, Amelie was, it's film school in 2 hours. I don't know.
I mean, that's certainly the case could be made. It's and I was thinking too that the stuff we see at that age, when you're just coming out of high school, when you're figuring out who you're going to be, those are the movies that we often bond to, bond with the most ferociously, because they're how we cement our own identities. For me, it's late 80s stuff.
What would be for you? The Amelie in your life?
I don't know. My film school was definitely Back to the Future.
That's a great one.
Yeah, which I went and saw every week on cheap on 250 Tuesdays.
You saw it how many times?
15 or 16.
Wow!
Like for the for the entire summer. Yeah, well, I saw it week after week after week. That was my summer. That was the summer of 1985, and I was 17, And I just took it apart and put it back together again over and over and over again.
I was watching Adventures in Public School today, and I was thinking about that because there's this section in the middle that we kind of reworked.
Oh, yeah.
And I was watching, and I was like, I think, you know, it's so clear right now. It's so clear to not have had this and to connect these two dots, you know, at like 75% through the movie. It's like, oh, it made so much sense to just trim that little scene, the meat of the middle of the scene out, and to kind of connect these two dots, and it just makes it so much sharper and clearer. And it's like, why couldn't we have seen that in the script form?
Yeah.
So it's amazing how you can do that.
So when did you figure it out? Was it test screenings or editing?
It was in test screenings, and no, it was also in editing. Yeah, we knew it didn't work in the editing and early on, probably right before the test screenings. And then once we got rid of it, you know, it was so much clearer.
Yeah. Oh, that stuff's amazing too.
I know, but you got to have the fat to just start kind of trimming down. And just slowly chipping away, and you know you're probably going to get there, but you can't just cut it right away. You got to go, okay, well, let's hang on a little bit. How much can we hang on? But yeah, I have no problem just chopping it out and throwing it on the ground.
Yeah.
Because every single thing gets cut down. Everything is trimmed and crunched, and, you know, every scene, you know, goes through that. So.
Yeah. And so much of comedy is about precision and structure, too. So.
Yeah.
You're building beats that have to echo with each other at precise moments. I mean, that stuff is incredibly intimidating to me, just to see it structurally. And, you know, like, how long is too long between reference points, and when can you...
Are they going to laugh? Are they going to miss the next line if they're laughing?
Yeah.
If they can't hear, you know, what that person said? Yeah, I know. And then, you know, you just get kind of immune to your own film because you've watched it 100 times and you're like, Is this still funny? Is this making sense? I can't even tell anymore. So, yeah.
Yeah. It's, yeah. I guess you need the illusion of fresh eyes, right? But you also need literal fresh eyes. You need to put it in front of people.
Test screens.
Yeah,
those test screenings are very useful. And then they go across the board. You know, some people are, you know, not liking this character. Some people are loving that character. And you're like, okay, well, I can't listen to either of those people. I got to go down the middle.
Right.
And because every person that watches it from a different experience, you know, and so the demographics, like, you know, people probably in your demographic weren't the top for our film. Actually, I do know that your demographic was not the top for our film. Oh, yeah. That was actually the lowest scoring.
Really?
Yeah, it was much more in the middle-aged women that scored very high for it, that we were connecting with Judy.
I don't know. I connected with everybody. I thought,
that's,
you know,
good.
It's, yeah, as pandery as that sounds. I think it's
usually someone who's in your demographic who's got more of an artistic flair than they connect.
Maybe. I just
generally.
I'm just thinking, like, I'm old enough that I remember being all of those people. Like,
right.
I have the range of experience that I've been the awkward kid. I've been the worried adult, not a parent, but. You know,
the worried adult.
Yeah, I've been on the outside of all of those situations.
Yeah. Well, that's good.
Yeah.
That's good.
Well, I connected to it, and that's what counts.
Yeah.
Damn it.
Damn it.
That's the demographic of the critic speaking. It's like, you know, if I get it, that's all that matters. This film is made for me. but what was I going to ask you? There was one other thing about...
Amelie?
I was going to ask if you thought it could work today, but I think it still can. Like, it's not like a remake situation, but I'm always...
I wonder that. It's a curious question.
Yeah.
Like, does stuff land the same way
if
it was pulled out of time and dropped in right now?
That's it, right? I mean, it's such a specific movie, but I don't know that it's specific to 2001. It might just be specific to that movement in cinema.
Yeah.
And I think it could.
Yeah. I think it would.
We're in a weird place where a lot of the stuff from the late 90s is coming back.
Yes.
Because it's the 20-year thing. Like, people who grew up with it on video are now curious to see what it looks like in a theater.
Yeah, it's now hitting like that late 80s, early 90s that people are nostalgic for.
Yeah. And it's so strange to think that, I mean, it was only 16, 17 years ago, but it feels like a lifetime. Everything is a lifetime now.
Yeah.
But the rights just resurfaced in the States. I think it's just come back out on Blu-ray.
Only?
And so, it's been available here all along because Alliance had the rights, but then Miramax sold their catalog purchase and a bunch of stuff disappeared and is coming back again. And I'm really curious to see if it hits, because I want it to. I want it to get a resurgence.
Well, I think we should try to do that. I think we should pull it from the history and see if we can pop it into the future.
That's what the show is for.
You watch Back to the Future. You've got this figured out,
yep.
Don't you?
In theory.
Don't you have a time machine?
Yes.
No. You watched it enough times that you should be able
You'd
to make
able
your
to
own
reverse
time
engineer it.
Yeah.
No, that's a Galaxy Quest scenario, which is also going to be 20 years old soon.
Right now, we're also looking at Norm's time machine over here.
It's just a box. It's the primer version. Right. You have to get in and turn it on. It's a whole thing. It's a whole thing.
It's like a coffee thing. You put it on automatic time, and then, you know, at 9 in the morning, we're going to go to a different time.
Cool.
Yeah.
Well, when that happens, we'll let you know how it went. I'm starting to work my head around the future perfect tense.
Right.
It'll be good. It'll be good. Well, we'll find you guys. But meanwhile, you know what? Turn off this podcast and go see if iTunes is showing Amelie in the number one or two position. That'll be how we know.
Yes, exactly.
So if that happened, you're welcome.
My thanks to Kyle Rideout, whose new comedy, Adventures in Public School, is available for sale and rental on iTunes and Amazon Video in the U.S. and available for pre-order on iTunes Canada. It is a very smart, very charming film, and you should see it, especially if you're a fan of Judy Greer or Andrea Bang or Grace Park. It's really good. You can find Kyle on Twitter at Kyle Rideout, all one word, and you can find Amelie on Blu-ray and DVD from Lionsgate in the U.S. and from E1 in Canada. It's also available on iTunes and Google Play. As always, you can find me on Twitter at Norm Wilner and elsewhere on the internet at NowToronto.com. You can also find this podcast on Twitter at Semcast, S-E-M-Cast, and on the web at SomeoneElsesMovie.com. If you feel like leaving a review on iTunes or Apple Podcasts, that would be greatly appreciated. Every little bit helps, it truly does. Thanks for your support, and thanks for listening.